care of kind of things like that.
Have that type of budget, and salt is a big budget for these operations. So when we start with salt, that's a big budget number.
$100,000 per mile?
Per mile for Cartman's Canyon during a couple of the storms 2 years ago.
It's really more of a cost.
It is.
Issue than it is.
More a cost.
That would be
the number one. Yeah.
The challenge is you too, right?
They do.
Their
budget is significantly more than that.
But I understand.
Yeah. Is there an AC road sign that you can put up before
Westwood
as you head down Silver Creek?
So, I probably should look at coming down. Going up, there's 5 signs going up Silver Creek that are red and white that say four-wheel drive, change required, that kind of stuff is warning for people going up into Silver Creek. We should probably put the same warning down.
Yeah.
And what is, like, the protocol that you'd like constituents and community members to follow if they are having issues where there is 2 inches and they feel like their road or they see another road or they see issues? Would you like them to email Jody? Would you like them to email you? What is the best practice?
So, typically, you call into the office, and then that's disseminated out to me. So, like, if you call my number, it will end up coming to me. My office number here, 500-6613.
Okay.
It will get to me, and then I can follow up with our contractor on certain issues if necessary.
Okay, that's fabulous. Thank you.
Now, just a change that's occurred that a lot of people are not aware of because of the roundabout. Summit County Public Works now takes care of everything through the roundabouts all the way up to Mammoth Drive and then over to Bender Levy. There's been some calls about it being icy and so forth around the roundabout. I've let Public Works know about those, but we don't. The Secretary doesn't care for around the roundabout, so we're filing that.
And how about the bus stop?
The bus stop will stick there.
Right.
Yeah, they file the parking. Our contractor filed a bargain.
Because that hasn't been done consistently, just so you know. Like, when I personally drove into the drop-off lane, the sidewalk and the drive-through were not filed yesterday.
Now, the sidewalk is taken care of by Basin Rec, and that's a different thing that I have to work through.
Yeah.
Because that's a brand-new thing for them, and they have not budgeted for the trail and everything themselves. So I have to keep working on that for the bus. The traveling sidewalk.
Even the lane that goes through the middle one, that could be a drop-off lane, not the bus lane.
Yeah, I'll work on that.
Okay.
is there a way Basin Rec could pay us to do it, or pay you or whomever? Because it just seems like them deploying the equipment is going to be problematic and inconsistent.
We can have some additional discussion. Maybe more working through Public Works and Basin Rec to figure that out. It's just the nuance that we didn't have before.
Right. So, I mean, if you go off of how much care they put into the trails, the sidewalks are probably not going to fare much better.
Correct. So like, if you notice a few times, they come in and they wing it out and they leave that nice berm along.
Yeah.
So the kids got to really step over the 2-foot berm to get over to the bus. I try to address that. So we'll continue with the work in process with addressing that decision, right?
So. And then, Chris, the parking lot is kind of closer to the nail house. I'm guessing part of the problem that's not clear very well is that vehicles are parked there. What is the situation with overhead parking and whatnot? If that thing is not clear, obviously you can't do a great job, which they really haven't done a great job.
So currently the only no overnight parking times are over by the bus stop parking.
Yeah.
We didn't, the county selected those signs, but as a board, if you guys want to put some more signs up, we could do that, because the old Civic Center had those signs, and we would settle if someone was left there overnight.
So I guess that's the next question. Put up signs, that's one thing. Do we have the authority and willingness to tell people?
Yes, that's the Secretary of Property.
Okay.
So once it's posted correctly, we can do what is necessary.
How do you do enforcement?
I just call Park City Authority and they come pick it up.
Really, that's lending to the problem.
I've seen some there. And we really haven't had that issue in the years past because it was a different kind of scenario. Yes, so if you guys want to give a little direction, I can make sure the proper signage is up everywhere, and then we can move forward from there.
Sure.
I just have another question with regards to salt. Is there a way just to call the hill part, back in Oak Ridge or wherever that fire truck couldn't get up? Is there a way just to handle it that way? At least people that live on top of those.
So it's possible if it's the asphalt roads. The dirt roads that we still have, we can't because it would destroy the road base and everything.
But you put sand on it.
Or sand.
We put sand on everything.
I don't think people know that. But you're talking about salt. Let me know you do sand.
So we'll apply sand when they're out doing their work. And actually today, I heard the fire trucks earlier. I didn't know where they went. So this is kind of the first inkling. But on Tuesdays, we actually have Wolf out because the garbage trucks can't get around sometimes, even though the garbage trucks are supposed to put chains on. I mean, we haven't had a snow event since Saturday. The roads are clear and nothing. They do get icy at night. And so we reapply on a Tuesday, typically for the garbage trucks to get around. I'll have to get a little more information on this Oak Ridge incident and just see because
Oak Ridge South. Upper, yeah.
And they couldn't get up The one I'm talking about was like a couple days ago. There was three weeks ago, a fire truck got stuck at the top. And then the paramedics came. They couldn't get the ambulance up. So they walked up to help the party that was up there, and thankfully they did not need to take the person in the ambulance. They would have had to try and
leave. I'll have to reach out just to see if it's typically emergency. Typically emergency services, if there's an issue, we'll reach out and say, hey, we had an issue today, and we need something, or if it's more immediate, we'll reach out immediately. I haven't received any stuff. And like even today, we know that there was a fire truck parked at the mill house for a while. So I have no clue where the other emergency services were in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So they actually left one of their vehicles down at our
parking area and went up with the all-wheel drive, with four-wheel drive, under their ridge up to the site with the ambulance. So I think the fire department is keenly aware now of
all of the
right, and making sure that the responding engines are.
I'll find out the date.
Okay. I wanted to move on. With regard to your question on the roads, we are going to have, I mean, the water study staff will give an update later on. It is on the agenda.
Okay. Can I ask one more question? Chris, what is the plow height throughout Silver Creek? You don't plow to the surface, right?
No, we don't plow to the surface. We leave a small amount up there. That, I would say like an inch or so.
Okay.
They set their equipment to that. And it has some skis, on those roads, so that they could, and that's to protect the yellow stuff
yeah.
as well.
So it's consistent everywhere.
Yeah, it's consistent everywhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Back to public comment. Please again put your name and address for the record. Other public comment?
Luann Luckenbach. On the token of, first of all, I want to say there have been several times that Silver Creek Road has been a sheet of ice, and I've called Chris and he had them come out and take care of it right away, and I appreciate that so much. And I appreciate knowing what our the regulations are, like 2 inches and all of that, so we know to set expectations. I'm concerned about the mailboxes, that we have ADA parking, which is ridiculous. We have ADA parking, but there's no way for anybody who, if they were using a walker or a wheelchair or anything else, could get to the mailboxes because it's packed with snow. And the sidewalk, there are sidewalks around that area that are shoveled, but not the sidewalk itself from the ADA parking to the mail house, I think really should be clear for legislation and all. I mean, it's just, I think it should be regulation. I appreciate that they brought a snow over and fall, so, you know, just feel a little shoveling myself, but I mean, there's a big chunk of oranges of ice that you just can't even get around now. But I really believe that if we could keep up with it when it happens, there won't be 4 inches of ice on that area. And for anyone who needs to use a cane or a walker, I know we have a lot of older people in our neighborhood. We've got ADA parking, and it's just like, ah, never mind. You know, park wherever you want, but you got to still go all the way around and make the maneuver. So that's my first thing. My second thing is, I'm wondering if we could, or who's the boss over allowing snowmobiles to be on our trails. I would like to allow snowmobiles on our trails. Currently, nobody can use them because they're packed with snow. And I think if we had a snowmobile, people that ride their snowmobiles up and down those trails, then maybe some people that walk could walk on the trail instead of on the street. So I don't know if that's something that Silver Creek can decide or if it's a county thing. That's what I'd like to know too. So,
I volunteer to tap them down.
Cool. Ah,
okay. Love that.
I appreciate
that. Okay. I'm sure. So within our neighborhood, we have several different trails. The east to west connector, which comes from I-80 over on Division Street. By Little Miners, it goes down after and it cuts all the way over to Bittner, comes along Wasatch Way and then Wasatch Lane. That is a basin wreck trail. From the Civic Center, going up Silver Creek Road, that's our trail. And those are really the two main trails when you get to those today. So all the other trails are ours within Service Area 3 that are built within the right of way.
So we can't.
So Basin Rec is not going to maintain anything other than theirs, even though it's been a couple of years since they maintained it or groomed it. They used to run a groomer down it for cross country.
And then if we were allowed snowmobiling, for example, or some other kind of mechanized activity on the service area trails, is there a level of expectation that we would maintain in a certain way? Or would they just be in their natural state?
I think my opinion would be is we would need to delegate something or hire somebody to do that, just because I think if you let a free for all, you're going to have every teenager and an old person just ripping up and down. I think it's good to get it packed down, but I think there has to be some limitation. Because right now, the current there's no motorized vehicles at all on the trails.
And you do see a fair number of people using the trails either cross country, kids walking on to stay off the roadway.
Down below you might. There's no light on the trail.
What I'm saying is it never happens on the upper.
And just from this first record, half boards have talked about grooming the trail and getting a little groomer and stuff like that, but it didn't ever go past the dollar that it did. One of the little groomers that you see in the Basin Rec uses, I think, like $7,000 or $8,000 for whatever type of machine.
Rumor has it there's a couple of those in our neighborhood that people own. But none of those flowers for this whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, if there's some volunteers or something, I think we're open to discussion because it's a need for a part of our community.
Very
right. I agree. It would be a mess and a disaster just to let residents ride their snowmobiles on there and do it. But if there was one person designated, there'd be more harm than good. But if there are groomers that could pull behind bigger snowmobiles pouring into reds that will kind of flatten it out. But if everyone was riding on it, it would just be ruts and whoopsies, and then they start ripping off the dirt and grass, and there'd be noise. But one snowmobile with a groomer on it could do the job. It'd just be finding out once.
We get resident complaints from people snowmobiling, like even in the wall property here, like that park teachers tell us aren't that really hard, but we need to get calls and complaints about that. Any residents that live here.
Okay, so moving on, I think we can move on to the next public comment.
I didn't hear about the ADA thing.
Oh, I don't know. I think that's probably something we have to look to do. I think that goes hand in hand with what you were saying with Basin in terms of clearing.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see what that is. Basin doesn't get out in hand trouble, so maybe even another step that we will need to contract and purchase one to help.
Okay.
Because it's something
like
new and different
than
what we had in the past.
Okay. If we could maybe circle back on what ideas for safety reasons on that would be awesome. Okay. Moving back to public comment.
That was probably why I talked to the patron. So I'm honored to be part of the Park City Leadership Group. And when I first went, several months ago, Mayor Nana was told about the Silver Cream. You guys are real, I know you're just not good. And so last night, I was like, all right, there. We have a new board of travel, and we have a lot of different mayor engaged, and the team are great and staff, and so everything's really good. So I kind of like, I'll send a message to the mayor and everyone. And then we drove over in our buses. There's about, 30 of us were on this Park City Leadership Series. And then we drove over to Colville to meet with the person we met with the Park City Council and was explaining how the city government works in Park City. Then we drove to Colville and met with that group. And again, I raised my little hand and I said, I just want to thank all of you for nominating our two wonderful board members. Right. And also I wanted to let you know that Silver Creek is really experiencing a transformation and we're feeling and how we felt come together and really just build the board and the team. So just wanted to thank you for shout out.
Three of us today nominated. One, two, and three.
Why did I'm a new member, John?
Hi, John, nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too. Why was Glenn is feeling from
I
kind of know, but I just
can't. There's many, many reasons.
Okay.
And I'm getting new, like, I'll let you know that I'm,
good.
We can all share the best of the things or
move it in the right direction.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any other public comments? Any on the phone, Jody?
No.
No one? Okay. So with that, I will close the public comment portion of the meeting, and we can move to election of board officers. since you have everyone here. And I'm not sure exactly what the protocol is or the best practice is for this. If people want to just kind of keep things as is, or if people want to re-elect or re-nominate people, and kind of open it up to the board to decide.
Well, we've got a lot of new members, right?
Yeah, I mean, if anyone is interested in the position, feel free to either self-nominate yourself, or if there's somebody who privately shows that they want to be nominated, feel free to nominate them.
Are we doing certain positions? What are we starting
with?
Go
through the different positions. Let's hear what Nathan
has. I just wanted to respond to your question about the process. And so just a couple quick points. The rules of order and procedure are clear that at the first regularly scheduled meeting in January, there will be an election for the chair and vice chair, and then they will serve for a term of 1 year, and they can serve for consecutive terms, but they can't serve for more than two consecutive terms. Our policies have always been set up, and typically we've had the elections for all the board officers starting in January, but the non-chair and the non-vice chair, the other positions, clerk and treasurer, it's been a little bit more ambiguous about when their terms begin and end. So the one thing that's clear is we do need to do an election for the chair and vice chair. And like you said, if you have new board members that we didn't have before, you know, we could keep the current chair and vice chair in place, or if someone else wants to run. Typically the way that works is someone will make a motion to nominate someone. There'll be some discussion, a second, and then there'll be a vote. With the other two positions, I think the code, those could probably continue in effect, but I do think it probably makes more sense to just get everybody on the same cycle.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably the board's intent. I don't want to speak for the board, that when you elected the officers, it was more to kind of fill in for the remainder of the departing officer's term. So that's just, if you had a question on the procedure, and that's typically how it works.
Okay. And I see that the papers were circulated as we need those yet. I mean, feel free if you guys want to nominate someone, or if you want to, whatever you guys decide.
I nominate Otto to be treasurer.
Oh, we're going to treasurer?
Okay.
Okay.
I nominate Scott to be chair. Okay.
Second? I'll second Otto and I'll second Scott.
Okay.
So all those in favor?
It would probably be easier if we did one position at a time.
Okay.
Thank you,
so all those in favor of Otto for treasurer?
Does Otto want to be treasurer?
If you have to acknowledge it, they heard it. Yeah. Okay. I could do that.
You want to do that? Okay. So all those in favor of Otto,
aye. Aye.
Okay.
Scott motion, who's second?
Dave second.
And then?
And then with regard to chair, Scott nominated.
Rick nominated.
Scott.
David second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And so then we would have vice chair and clerk, because you were in the clerk position.
Yeah.
Scott was treasurer.
Scott was treasurer. We have Otto as treasurer now. So.
I'll nominate myself to be vice chair.
I'll second it.
All those in favor?
Right.
Yeah.
Is he
abstain
or
no?
Yes.
I'll abstain. So just for the recording, Rick nominated himself for vice chair. Scott Wicken seconded it. He had 6 votes in favor and 1 abstain.
Jody, when we don't have a unanimous vote, can we get a roll call vote on that?
Yes, sure. Let's start with Scott, please.
Aye.
Aye.
David is
a yes. Derek abstain.
Carrie, aye.
John Ball, aye.
Otto Blum, aye.
Rick Parisi, aye.
And so the last position we have to solve for is clerk. Any nominations for clerk? I'll do clerk.
I nominate Terry for clerk.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So, Terry, you nominated yourself?
No, Scott nominated her.
That's why it's different. Yeah, sorry. Scott nominated Terry. Rick seconded. All in favor?
Yeah.
And so one thing that I just want to point out that I think is important is that Derek and I were chair and vice chair for a very short time, but there were some things that are in our bylaws that are very important that we continue the momentum on. Some of them were like requirements for annual, unless we reevaluate the bylaws, that annual performance reviews, annual review of HR policies. I know that we had designated Derek to kind of run those. It's not necessarily a chair or a vice chair position to run those performance reviews. So I do think that because our bylaws dictate and mandate those things, that we need to make sure that we continue those processes.
And the job descriptions.
And the job descriptions. And so there are things that are out there that we started that just because it's a new chair construction, we shouldn't let them fall to the wayside because they actually are in our bylaws. And I think it's even, I have to look whether it was in January, we're supposed to review some of those things. And we had already talked to John about doing performance reviews by the March cycle, like most companies. So, you know, I would suggest that we still have Derek, who's done a fair amount of work on that, kind of continue it with John, you know, as like kind of a committee or a project. But we just don't want to lose track of the work that we already started.
Well, great. And as far as, like, it's chair and vice chair are really ones really charge the meeting, right? It's not
Right? Yeah, I mean, when I first asked John when I was new to the board, like, who reported to, he was like, Suzanne. And then when Derek and I were in the positions, we were like, who do you guys report to? And it was like, we report to the board. So I think the staff reports to the board, as Nathan had clarified at some point. And I think that you guys are running the meeting in terms of agenda topics, like when things, like before a meeting, yes, the chair does set the agenda, but the board can bring forward things to be suggested. And the way Nathan described it and John described it was, if the board are bringing up things, the chair shouldn't be blocking things to be put on the agenda type of thing. You know, like, and that was like, when I was on it, you know, like people had suggested stuff that I may have not wanted on the agenda, but that's how it was described to me. So.
I mean, that's been also Nathan has
said. Jody, did you have something to say?
Nathan just raised his
hand. Okay. Nathan?
Carrie, I just wanted to confirm what you're saying. That's correct. All of you were appointed, but you're all ostensibly elected officials, right? You're serving in an elected role. And so nobody's vote should have more power than another. And so you're supposed to make your decisions collectively. The chair does primarily serve as the person in charge of conducting the meetings. And there are some things in your rules, and these can also be amended. And I do think that now that you have a new board, a completely new board, that it does make some sense to go through and review these rules of order and update them. I think there's some things that we need to update with some of the more recent policies we've adopted for some recommendations from the auditor's office. But the idea is that the board is who is governing the staff. And there is even expressed language in here about the chair not being able to govern the staff unilaterally, because that would be contrary to the board acting as the governing body. Now that said, you know, every board's different, and boards, like you said, Kari, can delegate certain responsibilities. So for instance, you were talking about Derek doing performance reviews, which is certainly something the board can do. And in the past, a lot of the boards have said, hey, we want the chair to work on some of these day-to-day operation things. But that's up to each board to make that determination as how you make some of those assignments.
Excellent. Thank you for that clarification. And so I think that concludes that portion of the meeting, and I will turn it over to you, Chair.
Please finish the meeting out.
Okay.
Thank you for what you've done so far.
Okay.
Please finish it out.
Administrative
and financial conflicts of interest disclosure.
So basically, and John's out themselves, just trying to take care of everything that happens annually. So there's certain things that happen annually, the board training, which I think Nathan might speak to, but also we always have staff sign every year and all of the board members sign the ethical behavior pledge form. This is something that John basically learned about in one of the water meetings for rural water. So you'll see every board member has in front of them the ethical behavior pledge. I can sign it as your witness or somebody else can. But then there's a conflict of interest disclosure form as well. Again, this is legally something that we've implemented, I think, last year is what they did. Nathan also brought to my attention some new legislation about additional disclosure conflict of interest, but actually did not apply to us because we're under $10 million budget. Nathan's raising his hand, so I'm going to let him speak to you further.
Yeah, so this the requirement to file a conflict of interest disclosure has been on the law for a while, but what we did is we adopted this conflict of interest policy. These were things that we were doing to help implement some of the best management practices the state auditor had, including the ethics pledge. And so just as a quick overview, the way that the state law works with conflicts of interest is, for instance, these are the main categories that you need to disclose in this form. I still think everyone should fill it out, even if you don't have a conflict of interest, because then we can show that we've complied with it. But for instance, if you own a business that's regulated by the service area, then you need to disclose that type of a conflict of interest. For a water district that's, you know, not quite the same as, say, if you were in a city and you had a business, any business within a city would have a conflict of interest because you have to have a business license. Here, it's a little different. At the same time, if you are an employee of a business that works with the service area. So, for instance, if you were an employee of Wolf, which has a contract with us for snow removal, you would have to disclose that conflict of interest. If you work for them or if you had a substantial ownership interest, usually 10% or more. The other conflict of interest is if you're being paid by someone to get certain approvals from the service area, that's something you're allowed to do, but you have to disclose it. And then lastly, if you have any sorts of investments or things that would create a conflict of interest, then that's something that you would need to disclose. I think that's usually pretty rare for water districts, but nevertheless, those are the four types of general categories that you should be disclosing in these forms. And what Jody said is that there was a requirement that just went into effect. This is the first month it's ever been done, and basically the legislature is requiring all city council members and all county council members and special district boards with a budget over $10 million to fill out the same type of disclosures that legislators do. It's very duplicative of the conflict of interest disclosures you're already doing, and a lot of it is actually pretty detailed. And so in my opinion, since you guys don't have a budget of $10 million, you don't have to do it. I don't think you need to, because the normal conflict of interest of disclosures that you do anyway will cover most of that information.
Thank you. So everyone has the documents. If we fill them out, we can hand them to you.
And then we keep them on file.
Okay, great. Approval of December 9th, 2024 minutes. I assume that everyone received them in the packet and has had a chance to review them. Would someone like to make a motion to approve the minutes?
I motion to approve them.
I'll second it.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Soft motion. Rick, second. Commandments?
Yes. Approval of expenditures. Otto? Were these ones that you already reviewed?
The ones in the packet.
Okay. You have seen it before, though.
Yeah. Okay. I already initialed those.
Okay. So, would you like to make a motion? Someone to make a motion?
My motion to approve the financial. I'm sorry, expenditures.
One second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Great. And now I think we're going to.
I just repeat the recording. Scott Richard made a motion. Otto seconded. All in favor?
Great. And before we jump into the next portion, I know that you had mentioned that you have to leave early.
Yes.
Was it now that you have to leave, or?
No.
Okay. Okay, perfect. So with that, we have on the calendar for Dave Sanderson to do a 2024 Q4 financial review.
He's online.
Okay, great.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is for Lot 101, 2024 to 1231. So this is the entire year of the general fund and water fund. Now, because they're on a accrual basis, there's still some items that are still coming in. So, for example, property taxes, there's some that will be collected in December that will be sent to us in January, and we'll accrue them back to this financial year. Also, some expenditures are coming in January invoices that were for December work will also be accrued. So this will slightly change a little bit, not much, but it will change. So on page 31, that you're looking at right now, is the operational budget report for the general fund. And this goes from 31 to 32. So Vince, you want to go down one page and show the end? So that's the general fund for the year, subject to a little bit of change. Right now, the budget remaining is 37, but I'll explain a little bit more in the further report that I do. So the next page is going to be the capital projects fund. And so it had a balance of 97,000, and we transferred 139 to it. So now it has a budget, 236,000 of cash. The next one down is the water fund, and this is the revenue side of the water fund. And if you go down a little bit farther, is the expenditure side. Now, go down to the red-green report then, and then we can come back if we have any questions on this. So this is a report that basically mimics what you just seen above. However, the fourth column is a projection that I make based on past years, so I can kind of guesstimate because of the accrual problems, situations. So you can see in property taxes, we've collected 472, and I'm estimating 525. So there's still a few things that are just right on. Class B road allotment, there's still another payment to be made, but I think that's accrued back. And most everything else is right on what's already there. So I'm estimating the budget was 59. I'm estimating 942 of revenue, and that's in the general fund. And if, on the expenditure side of this, again, I'm estimating some things have already taken place, like salaries have already been, they're up paid up until 12/31, so they'll stay consistent. But there'll be a few things that we get bills for, like engineers that did some work in December that we accrue that. So this will slightly change a little bit. So there's a few things, like if it snowed late in December and work is still giving us a bill, that will be accrued that. So go down to the end. So right now, right at this stage, I'm estimating that the general fund is going to end up with a 66,703 positive balance. And that's with transferring $139,250 to the capital project fund. Okay, down one page is that the capital project fund is not illustrated here because it has no revenue or no expenditures. So that's a contribution. So here's the water fund. Again, this is again a report that I project the final column out based on the past, based on my years of experience. And so this is the top side is the revenues, and you have the expenditures, the payroll, professional fees, legal fees, and utilities. We'll still be getting a few bills in that area. So if you go down one more page, I'm estimating that this fund will decrease, one more page, decreased by 71,000. And the majority of that is that,
emergency
water leak expenditure made the budget forward. So, that's what's taking place right there. The district, as of 12/31, has $2.5 million in cash, 1.324 in the general fund, 236 in the capital projects fund, 946 in the water fund. By the prior meeting, I said there was about $900,000 in the general fund, and you can see we got this property tax payment in December, which increased that balance to $1,324,000. So that's basically it. I'm happy to answer any questions or comments or concerns. There is one other additional report that Polaris has. It's called a financial report, and it lists out all the assets and liabilities and basically the cash position. And we can provide that report if needed, but basically boards are concerned about the budget report, which is revenues and expenditures. So happy to answer any questions or comments.
I would ask, Scott, what percentage of the reserve should be, at what point does it get to be so high relative to the total budget that we can discuss a, I don't want to say a tax cut, but freeze a tax, or not have a tax increase, if you will?
Okay, so I've been asked that question quite a bit on various other entities, and so I always refer back to the revenue budget line item. So the water fund, we'll kind of go in reverse. The water fund has a revenue of about $1 million, if you end up. And right now you have 946,000. So you're slightly below a 1-to-1 ratio. Now you should never go below a 0.50, which means you only have 400,000. But depends on your future projects, or if you're going to bond, and you should have a little bit more additional than 1x. There's a sewer district in Utah County that is about 40x. So I'm telling you, they have $40 million for a $1 million budget in comparison. The general fund, if you go back to the general fund, and the total revenue for the general fund is about $1 million, you have $1.3 million, so you're 1.3x. That's fine. You got to consider that you guys have snowstorms, which are very volatile and roller coaster. So you got to have some funds in case you have a thing. But you're in relatively fine financial state. You probably could do a little bit better in the water fund based on future projects and the future payment of the loan you're getting. That would take place in 26 or 27. But that's kind of an overview.
So if you have to look at this in terms of the bond money, if you look at this in terms of the bond money we're going to have access to for the other projects, is there a way to use that bond money to mitigate an increase in rates, water rates?
No, by law, you're supposed to, when you get the bond money, you're supposed to use the bond money is only for projects only. Can't be used for anything else.
Right, but what about the capital expenditure for projects?
You outline in the bond document what the projects that the bond is going to pay for. Both bondholders want to know what they're buying.
So keep in mind we've been kind of banking money, capital, knowing that we were having this capital improvement to the water system. Not knowing what initial payments were going to be, we had to ensure we were fiscally responsible there.
These financial statements will be audited by the auditors for state audit guidelines. All right, like I said, there'll be a few changes, and I have to get a few reports from URS and the county to disperse the county property taxes by state categories. but it's relatively not going to change much by the end of December. As soon as I receive the URS report, then the lottery should start the lottery.
Okay. Any questions? Any additional comments? Give me a second, my screen. So with that, we're waiting for Gary. Is that what you were saying?
Yep.
So we can kind of move past that until he arrives, I assume, unless if he's running by phone or if
no, he's coming in person.
Our next agenda is actually water, which is the rate that we have to from
Okay, yeah, I lost my screen, so thank you. So, Vince, do you want to give an update where we are with Borough Water?
Yep. We've received the initial draft models, and as we all know with models, they take some tweaking, especially in the early stages. The initial run of their model has some anomalies, and we're going to go to a G5 with Rural Water tomorrow morning to try and identify if it's user data or billing code. Clearly, when it shows a $222 million revenue stream, there's a problem with the model. So it's not uncommon for these initial models to go through a number of iterations. The model has to take an acoustic tier structure for our water system, so I imagine that's where some of the anomalies are.
And are they modeling it against statewide data, nope, local areas similar to us?
A lot of its study is done purely based on our water system expenses and revenue to ensure that there's enough revenue to not only cover expenses, but also for capital improvements, depreciation, et cetera. Obviously, this water rate study is going to have to include bond payments for the capital project. So,
and what time is that meeting tomorrow, did you say?
It's at 9 a.m. that'll allow us to really forecast where we are and where we need to be to ensure stability with our water system.
That's specific to connected?
It's specific to all the revenue and all the expenses of the water enterprise, so that includes connected air and upper wells. So it's going to, basically what they do is, take our past user data, plug it in with the water rates, and so we have everything from people on the water system, standby fees, to well users on an annual fee. Then they'll start plugging in expenses, and they'll model out what kind of that capital money you need to put aside. And because this is all they do, they have a pretty good idea of life expectancy of your water system and replacements. And hence, we're kind of going through that right now with our big water improvement project.
So they're not actually using data from other areas. It's just our data?
Correct.
And then using models that are created from the industry? Or
yeah, they do a lot of water rate studies. When I first joined the board many, many years ago, it was explained to me by Kurt with Rural Water back then. And he said you can't compare your water rates to another water system because they are two completely different beasts. There's no two water systems in the entire state that are even close to being identical to each other.
Mm.
For instance, we have 210-ish connections on our water system. Summit Water probably has north of 4,000 to 5,000. So trying to scale or take into effect just simple infrastructure, right? You've got, we've got sort of connections with any idea how many houses that you have. I used to know it off the top of my head.
sorry.
Dave wants to jump in.
Go ahead, Dave.
I want to explain this. When it's a rate study, it's internal to the rates of the district. When it's a rate comparison, that's external water companies that you compare your rates against. I guess. But I'm totally with Vince on this. Everybody's topography is different. The well distance is different. People buy water, pump water. So I don't think there's a great comparison between entities. I agree with Vince. That's basically what I wanted to call it.
So what we're getting is a rate study, not a rate comparison. Right?
Correct.
Okay.
So with that, we know that you had kind of put it out there to the board and to avoid a forum. Like, I know I wanted to attend that. So can you send a link to join that call?
Sure.
It's a virtual call.
Yep.
And obviously, we just have to be careful about how many of us attend that. I don't know if it would be beneficial as one of the new board members for you or Dave to kind of also be a part of that, you know, to have you guys. Yeah. So if you could maybe just make sure we don't have a quorum on that.
Okay.
Great.
Yep. I think, you know, treasurer might be good if you're free to join that meeting. And then anybody else that.
Well, I think it could be anyone who has an interest. I don't think it has to be treasurer, clerk, or chair. I think it should be just those who are available and indicate they're wanting to participate. So I don't know if that's something we want to make sure we just don't have.
I'm not available at that time tomorrow, so I won't be in it. That helps.
And you're available, to then?
I think so.
Okay. And you're not available?
Mm-hmm.
And Scott?
I can do it, but if you want to do it there.
We're seven, so...
You can go. Have, yeah.
Come on. Three? You can have three?
Four is the quorum.
Four.
Okay.
You can do three, right?
I'm 50-50 at that 9 o'clock.
And he doesn't know. So.
I tell you what, if there's extra capacity, I'll do it. But if anyone else wants to do it, if you can't and you can't, it would just be between, I guess, you four. And then if it ends up being two people, I'm happy to jump on.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah, you guys can all jump on and then if you just thank God.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Before we move on, I have a quick question that's come up in a couple of different contexts. I just wanted to get, I guess, Nathan's input on this. There's been a couple issues, the water study being one of them, I can't remember what the other one was, where Vince has expressed concern about sharing information with us without or before redacting what he considered to be PII. So Nathan, is there a different standard like that the employees can view certain materials, the board cannot? Or what is the situation there?
No, and I think I sent an email out yesterday on this, but the board's entitled to see this draft information. I think there was a different opinion from different board members as to whether there was utility in seeing the draft at this point or not. But no, the board's entitled to see this information in draft form.
So I understand. I'm specifically trying to drill down on the pushback against information, sharing information that has what some might consider PII.
Yeah, and the board's entitled to see that information. Now, the board can't disclose stuff that's protected, controlled, or private. And so that's the one thing that we need to keep in mind. But the board can see draft information. The board's entitled to see all of these documentations. And if the board wants, the board can designate which staff members have access to sensitive information as well.
So in part of Vincent's response, I thought part of it was information that had to be taken out for protection. Are you saying he doesn't need to take that out?
Not for us.
Not from board. I think now to be clear, every board's different. Some boards, you know, when they have sensitive information, and what happens when they do these rate studies, and I have not seen this rate study, I don't know what it says, but typically when you have these drafts, what they'll go through, and we have a small district like you, they'll go through and they'll list everybody's name, their address, and their water use. Now that won't make it into the final rate, of course, but that's what they use to calculate the initial numbers. And so I think that you have, so these rate studies do have the potential to have private or protected information that shouldn't be disclosed. And so some boards will say, hey, I don't want to take a risk of this leaking, because if it does leak, then there are some pretty significant penalties to that. And so some boards will say, well, we don't want to see stuff that's got you know, sensitive information on it, so redact it before you send it. But the board is entitled to see it as it is, and that's and if they want to, they can see it. And I think in this case, we don't even have a file; we just have a link that Rural Water provided to us. And so my recommendation was, let's just have Rural Water give the board members access so they can click on the link. And that way we don't have a file that can be forwarded or lost or somehow accidentally distributed. We just have a link, and the board members that are interested can go and see it.
Is there a standard for that? Like, in the past, we would take a file, assign like a tiny URL to it, push that out with permissions on it, and then that way it wouldn't ever, it'd be unlikely to kind of circulate in the universe. Is there, to your point though, is there a standard for that? That applies to the staff and us?
Not one that's implied by, that's required by state law, but you can certainly adopt one if you want.
Is there like a boilerplate that we could adopt so we don't have to reinvent it, just so we're all on the same page?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm not a cybersecurity person, but, you know, I'm sure there's probably some standard that we can use for sensitive information like that.
Okay.
What's the, personally identifiable information, so here's your name, social security number.
I personally don't want more information than I need in terms of, especially that type of stuff. Just my.
I guess the question is how much people's information were on that was redacted. Like, I can't imagine that's been redacted.
Well, phone number, names, addresses, legal descriptions of names, etc. And so, you know,
was anything else redacted from that?
No, those were basically any of the, as Derek pointed out, any of the unique identifiers were pulled out.
I mean, I think the point is, though, that, like, we've had Nathan validate that, like, the staff should have the same, you know, something is being studied or researched or done by the staff, the board should have that same access. If we're being careful about protecting what will leave the board or presented by the public, I think the point is that the staff shouldn't be withdrawing stuff or holding stuff from the board.
Yep. I think that's a good point, and, you know, if the board wants to set a policy with that.
I don't think we need a policy. I think Nathan said the policies are there in terms of best practices. So, any other questions from the board?
Well, Nathan raised his hand.
Okay, take
care. Unless the board has other questions, I've mentioned to some of you, I think I sent an email to the board that the Division of Water Resources came out with a report right before the end of the year that I thought there's a chance that it might result in some legislation this session that could impact how water providers set their rate. I got confirmation today. The Division of Water Resources Director was speaking at a Water Council's meeting, and she confirmed that there is legislation in the works that will be making some tweaks to the tiered rate structure. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but I've had a few conversations with her, and my guess is that what it's going to do is either give water suppliers more authorization, which is my guess. I don't think it's going to be mandatory, but to have higher prices at the top end of a tiered rate to incentivize conservation. That was one of the recommendations from the report. So I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know if it'll pass, but my recommendation is that we continue working on the rate study, but we hold off on adopting anything and doing anything until we see what happens during the session. Because I don't want to go through the process of doing something and have to redo it because of a bill that gets passed.
When is that session, Nathan?
In the first week of March. So it's going to start the day after Martin Luther King Day. It'll go through all of February, and then it ends that first week of March. So we should know by the time we would do we would meet to adopt this anyway if we meet that third Tuesday in March. But you don't have anything, but we'll just need to see what the legislature does.
You already have tiered water pricing for our connected users.
We do, but what the report recommended was that the rates at the high end of these tiered rates need to be higher to incentivize conservation.
Yeah, we're set up that way.
Yeah, and it's entirely possible that our rate structure may be totally fine. I just don't know.
Okay.
Well, we never agreed on a rate structure. That was a proposed one, so we don't have a rate structure.
Every connected user pays tiered pricing is more expensive without it. Existing.
Not on the other.
Connected.
Okay. But as a policy as a whole, we're still evaluating the policy, therefore we're doing the water study. So we don't really have a policy in place. For the lower we do, but.
Well, for connected users, we have existing rates in place. The water study is addressing where do we need our rates to be to maintain liquidity. That's what rural water is doing. I think the legislature is more focused on excess usage fees for people who are not connected.
It's not the people that are connected. This whole upper lot private well thing is unique to you guys, but what the legislature found, what the report found, is that most tiered water rates, the top rates aren't high enough to effectively incentivize conservation. And so the recommendations were make some tweaks around that. And the other recommendation they haven't heard anything on in legislation is empowering public water suppliers to enforce water policies and conservation policies to have more teeth for people that use water excessively. I don't know what any of that's going to look like. I heard today that we are going to see some legislation on it. I don't think anything's been introduced, but I'll keep you posted as I find out more.
Great. Thank you.
And just to add, there was a recent DNR, Division of Natural Resources, for Utah that came out with a study on water as a whole and how it equates to the growth in the state of Utah, et cetera. I'll forward that out to the board. But it's pretty enlightening in a sense that it highlights those systems in the state that are very much underfunded and very old infrastructures that are going to have a hard time fixing that. And those systems that are kind of staying ahead of the curve and are being responsible from this water safety and conservation and their water systems. So I'll forward that out to the board tomorrow. I'll see you guys
moving. Great. And so now I think you had said that, are you the water engineer? I mean, the road engineer?
Yeah.
Okay. I hadn't met you. So thank you, Jerry, for coming. I see you on your horse. I think you live up the street from me.
Okay.
So, but I have not seen you in person here. So
thank you
for joining. So let's move to the roads update. At this portion of the meeting, we'll turn it over to Gary to present the 2025 road project. There was a comment just earlier on from the public. If you can also include updates to the trail, that was like a question that people were asking. Because there was, like $30,000 in the budget towards that. So I think people want to know a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So it should be on the last.
So we'll let you kind of walk us through that.
So I'll give you a little bit of history on last year. So three different budgets.
Gary, can you just announce who you are for the report?
Yeah, Gary Horton, WCG Road Engineer Consultant. We've been given three different budgets to use to plan and execute roadway improvements within the service area. I'll give you the first one, and there's a maintenance budget each year, and it's $150K, plus or minus, right? We have a leeway of maybe going under that, a little bit or over that, depending on what was the slush from the next year, okay? The second one, and the third one, the roadway, I'll call capital improvement, or CIP, is $120K a year, and the trail fund that's been allocated is $30K per year. So I'm going to hit on the second two because they're probably a little bit easier. Maintenance has a lot more diversity to it. Trail, $30,000, not to be rude, doesn't get you a whole long distance if you're trying to hire a contractor. Great for maintenance of little things here or there that either Chris is that we can hire to do or a very small contractor to fill small little areas. Like last year, we had held off on improving much on the trail until we got a $90,000 budget. And then we used a contractor here to give us a price here, meaning he was building the Silver Creek to Bittner project. Had equipment here, everything was here, trying to maximize those funds, asked him to give us a proposal. Came in under the 90, which was really good based on our estimate. Had we gone out and done a bid for contractors, what we had seen in the marketplace, they came in about $20K less. So we hired them, and you saw those improvements come up Silver Creek Road and partially along Westwood in some areas that are just kind of growing in with weeds and whatnot over time. So we're trying to make the connection to the parallel network that was coming in on the Silver Creek, the Bittner project, and trying to extend it out from there. That was the idea. And the area that really needed some retouching on some improvements. So this year, recommendation on the trail budget is really to set the money aside minus any trail emergency needs or immediate needs that are necessary. Once again, that's our recommendation. We can definitely go find a way to spend the $30K, but quality of the contractor and the length of the project won't be as high because the mobilization, the equipment, and some of those things that you have to do is the same whether you go $30,000, $60,000, $100,000. So that's the trail. Any questions on the trail?
What is the cost to mobilize the equipment necessary?
Depends on the project you do.
No, I'm starting to talk about for the trail.
Last year, not a whole lot. Like last year, they had it here, so I think their mob was like $500.
Okay.
Geez. Yeah. I would typically it's about 10% of the budget you set aside. That's what they'll, they put other numbers in there as well. Their overhead, a little bit of their management fee. There's not, we don't give a line item when we have contractors for bids for management and stuff like that. So they typically put that in there, mobilization.
And then what do you think would cost to finish Westwood?
Westwood, we could probably around $30K, if it was desired, yeah, the rest of the way. And a little bit, when you say finish Westwood with the same thing that we were doing,
yeah,
like clearing it, we asked them to clear an 8-foot path and put down for at least 3 inches of untreated base course, compact it. Really trying to just spray, we asked them to cut and spray the weeds, what they just did with one along with it does not.
What are they spraying with?
They didn't end up spraying, they just dug them with their back on, so they said, well, you do this, they just dug them out. If they did spray, I didn't see it, Chris, in my own.
They did spray.
Okay, there you go.
What did they use to spray with?
I know it's come up before. But
they got Rodeo from the county department, which is around it. So is that something that we can talk about? And I'm not a biochemist, so I don't know what's good or bad for animals or not, but I think it's pretty powerful considering people are out there with the animals and kids. And
we did discourage them in around the well, right?
Yeah. So in the end of the week, so if we can have different discussions in the future, but that did occur.
Okay, sorry.
I
saw him doing a lot of digging and didn't see anybody spraying, but I was out there all the time. Like, Chris was out there more than that.
Is digging more or less cost effective, or seems like it'd be harder, but
it seems like, yeah, they have the equipment, they have somebody they could sit on, they were kind of in use the past little time, so
yeah,
they did a little extra.
Spraying's obviously a lot easier,
but yeah,
I know it's not good stuff.
So we did ask them to cut it before they sprayed as well, so it's a more effective. So. That was our general recommendations. So roadway capital improvement project budget, similar. $120K doesn't get to a long pay in a roadway project anymore. Personally, my recommendation is more along the lines of at least $500,000, pushing towards $1 million, and even that is not as huge for a good contractor. You can get contractors, quality of the contractor you get becomes more questionable the lower the budget is about. So our recommendation for this year is really to set that money aside until we get north of $500K, and then plan a larger project. For example, this last year we spent it on the connection from the end of the Summit County project past the church's access point because the road had deteriorated because some of the things that had gone on in the past. So they rebuilt that. We built subbase, put down some asphalt, compacted it, did it right. But that cost us, I think it was around 170, 180.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your, and that, you can see how long the stretch for really, what, 2 year old, it should last us 20 years.
What was the stretch from the church?
Church to the roundabout. Just north of the roundabout where the county project ended, where the manhole were
yeah.
Kind of dip.
But not very far, though.
We use the church's money.
It doesn't go very far. I don't know where the money comes from,
right?
But I know it's $170,000. I don't know
That was kind of a question that I was a part of.
That was from the settlement.
Part of it, yes.
Okay.
So, but yeah. In theory, that should last 20 years with a little bit of maintenance. So, not just hands off, we can't do anything, but hopefully that section should last for 20 years if it's built correctly.
The maintenance on that wouldn't be any different than the rest of the road, though, right?
No. But I'll hit when I get to the maintenance side.
Okay.
We're just starting to get better at maintenance, I will say. For a lot of years, our maintenance was okay. There's a lot of methods for maintenance. The one caveat I will give to the capital improvement project is, some of you, as you've been here for a couple of years, 2 years ago, they rebuilt I-80. They road milled off about 1.5 inches, 2 inches. They came back in and put down new asphalt. Well, that's not performed well. You are fully aware of it. This year, they're redoing that section again. They're road milling off that asphalt. There's been a lot of conversations why that's happened. So like that. We do a lot of work for you though as well, but here nor there. If those road mill tailings become available, it is recommended to put those to use here. And the reason, more than most years I'd recommend it, asphalt content, in that last few years they'll have a little more asphalt. So when we place them down, if we can pack them and put what's called a slurry seal, add a little bit of asphalt to them, we'll do it right. It can give us a pretty good road service for work. Generally, road mill buildings are free. Contractor just doesn't want to haul them back somewhere. So we get those for free. What we're paying is to shape them and compact them. That's why some of our roads have the road mill tailings, because when the contractors, if it's the right contractor and it's the right road, we get those for free, and they're easier to maintain than a dirt road. Not ideal. It's not perfect, but it's cheaper.
So you're saying you could use those to turn dirt roads into paved roads.
Yep.
And even though there were issues with that, it's still good enough for...
Well, no, they cheered up in the... Yeah.
Okay.
It didn't perform there for a whole lot of reasons. Not the reasons.
Obviously, I've had more traffic and heavier trucks and all that.
But binding versus the way it bounds to the existing asphalt and stuff like that. So it's not an issue that we'd have here. So that would be the one caveat. If those become available, and I think if they become available, contractor may choose to use those because they may understand they have a higher value than we use for those as well. The winning contractor, I generally reach out to them, find out what they're going to do with them, and apply this opportunity potentially.
What's the longevity of that concept compared to just doing a regular asphalt?
Tailings, legitimately, depends on what you surface treat with. There's a lot of caveats because the tailings are not, one of the greatest damages to your asphalt surfaces is stormwater, right? And tailings aren't meant to keep the water off. They kind of seep through. If it's a flatter road, they tend to do a whole lot better. If it's a steeper road, then they tend to wash away more and stuff like that.
Time period, though.
Depends on the
years,
five years. And it gets 5 to 10, like,
so for most, I'll say most of the roads in Silver Creek are road mill. Beginning.
Underneath.
And then as we progressed and had budgets over the years, some of them are just rotomill with chip seal with their slurry on the top. Some of them have come back, we've come back in and actually put 3 inches of asphalt on top of those. So I mean, if you look at the cost effectiveness, the rotomill does this very well.
It's a good base, it's really not a great top surface.
Just don't think it's
better than dirt.
Yeah,
exactly. When dirt gets wet, muddy, you drive on the holes.
Yeah.
These at least fill in the holes. It's a good base for the starter. So right now,
great. And then do we use any perforated, like PVC, to capture water and speed sections to push off the side?
So, not right now. Not the board closed there, but,
is it effective?
We generally don't. So, I'll get to that. That comes to the main part.
So that's good.
Yeah, I'll hit it maintenance. But that's, the CIP is really put the money aside in the last one more tailing becomes available, then I would tap into those and try and cover some dirt roads to reduce the maintenance budget on the dirt roads.
And to Gary's point, this is one of the reasons why we banked that capital improvement money made for emergencies like 2 years ago in the snow, micro snow, and for opportunities like this when that free material does come in, then we can actually get a lot done for a small amount of money.
That's how I'm going to go perfect. Okay. All right, maintenance.
lot of different options we have with maintenance. So number one thing I mentioned earlier that creates a challenge with roads is once you've paved it, if the drainage is not getting off the roadways, if it gets stuck in the roadways, that's when freeze thaw this time of year, water seeps underneath, water freezes off, that's what comes off. So a big part of getting your roads to perform well is drainage. Not necessarily underneath in this way, but running alongside. So typically we'll crown the road, sheet flow of the water, and then having the right ditches on the side. A lot of our roads don't have appropriate ditches. If you get north of the Silver Creek or Oak Road south, that area where the ditch is about 6 to 8 feet wide and about this far deep, that's a great ditch. We don't have to go that to that depth of everything, but that ensures that the water gets off into the right place. The bottom of your ditch should be below the bottom of your typical section of the roadway, which is generally 3 inches up here, 3 inches of asphalt on 6 inches. So we generally like to have it about a foot down so that if water is percolating in, it's not coming back underneath the road. So to that end, you'll find a lot of maintenance things also talked about improving our ditch system. So when we do put road mill tailings on them or we put asphalt on them, hopefully we've got a place for the water to start to sheet flow to and continue to improve the road over time. One of the things we tap into, I was a previous county engineer, so I have a lot of good relationships with Summit County. They do a pavement preservation project throughout Summit County with a lot of different pavement options. Whenever we can, we try and piggyback them, economy of scale, because they have larger quantities. So when the bids come in, we're just one of 2,000 versus one of 200. Right? So mobilization, everything like that, they're already doing it. I will say the county also treats us pretty well in the fact that they kind of hit us for the actual physical charges, not from the general charges like mobilization or traffic control. Sometimes those, they kind of just cover them. So we tend to go a lot further. So this year, what they're doing, there's about 5 different surface treatments. The first thing I am recommending is a slurry seal, or not a slurry seal, crack sealing. Crack sealing, and you saw again in parking lots and whatnot, where they seal all the cracks in a row. I don't think I've ever done that on a paved road here in the service area. So we have a lot of problems that get created because the water gets down and makes the problem much larger because of water freezes. Typically, I would anticipate that being about a $10,000 to $15,000 price item for our roadways if we were just doing it on a yearly basis. We've never done it, so it is difficult to estimate because I didn't go and measure every crack. I don't think you want to pay me my time to measure every crack. So our estimating is around $40,000 to $50,000 to crack seal all of our paved roads that are in a good condition. I wouldn't recommend like where we put road mill tailings down. That's a worthless cost. But all of our paved roads, go crack seal all those. That's one of the first things that would happen. That happens around April or May. That's the early action in the Summit County. So we would put ours on the back of the Summit County project that's going out. They would include that when we talk to the contractor. They had a lot of stuff in 3 days. They'll come and seal all the cracks in our road. The other one that I've recommended is the county, once again, gives us a pretty good deal. The county uses their folks, their personnel that we don't pay for. They borrow equipment, which we don't pay for. They come and do a thin overlay of new asphalt. They've done it for us the last 2-3 years. Their recommendation has been in various places to come in and do us to an overlay, like inch of asphalt. So the key to that is where the road is in a condition that the pavement you're putting down would be good enough that it will support it, not just fall apart over the next year. This year, there's various places on Silver Creek Road, and I will always recommend Silver Creek Road first because it takes the most amount of traffic. When that goes down, it's going to be very costly to fix it. So you'll notice there's various segments on Silver Creek Road, so that is one of the areas we're recommending they fill in those. And then there's 2 or 3 side streets that part of the assessment is when people start swerving out of where they should be traveling
to stay safe because they want to miss a pothole, it's recommended data for those locations because that's no longer a safe environment. And as a service area, that's a liability. Mm-hmm. We've run when people are not comfortable driving where they should because of potholes.
How long does the crack ceiling last?
Crack ceiling?
Like a year?
No, like 5-10 years.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And then what's the assessment process? Like, how do you guys determine
so what gets done? Because I'm going to speak for Derek because he's not here, but
yeah.
Oak Ridge North is not in great condition.
Nope.
Present's not.
Nope.
What is the criteria of CapEx for that?
So I can probably, I need to send, I should have sent it with
this. I've seen, if this is,
yeah,
they sent this out a while ago. Or I don't know how I saw it like in the last year. With like a criteria, right?
Yeah, it's a criteria. Based on different one, number of volume vehicles on that portion of road. And we've broken Silver Creek into like three segments, and then generally the other segments are like Oakridge Road North, Oakridge Road South, kind of deal. The current condition of the road, what's its lifespan left, and the other one is safety. The top one being volume, traffic volume, second one being safety, the third one being the current condition of the road. So we go through that, kind of evaluate on all of those roads.
Objective do you think the criteria is? I mean, obviously there's some subjectivity to it, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm only asking that because I'm sure that, you know, if it's the road that somebody lives on, that's the most important road to them. But, you know, we have to be able to say, yeah, we understand that's important to you, but yeah, this is why you're in seventh place and not in second place. Or,
and that's exactly what it does.
Yeah.
It's just trying to remove the subjectivity or a technical criteria. Cumming County and others, there's like 10 criteria, but I'm not going to spend any money. I live here. Now I'm a resident here, so
right.
I try to get the right answer with the minimal effort.
Yeah.
To save money so we can put some money on the roads versus paying an engineer, which...
Yeah, and then the other part of that would be, is that something that we're able to share with people when they say, hey, how come you're not doing my road? And you say, well, you're on the list, but you're down here, and you might never get up there, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
might be
here. And I should have included a little bit. We do that every year. That's a yearly analysis. I do it a lot, honestly, based on life when I'm just driving around like that. You know, when I'm driving through the area, I kind of do an assessment. It's later when I get home.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tipping point where, let's say a road, before it becomes critical, does the cost become exponential? So if it just needs a little bit of care to keep it.
Yeah. Drinking your oil in your car, right?
Yeah, good roads are easier to take care of.
Yeah.
Right? They're the cheapest to take care of. That's crack sealing, so that's one of them. The other one is it's called a slurry seal. And if you do those both, from an overall standpoint, crack sealing is a very cheap maintenance method. Once you get past a certain point when you're digging down into the road, that's when you skip that scale. When it's now, it's not as efficient and you're not. If you were maintaining it, spending more money on maintenance, then you may not have gotten there.
So this might be a Pandora's box, but do you guys have any specific road observations you want to share about?
I think there are a lot of people in the community who do.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not here tonight. And being right after the holidays is difficult. What I think would be helpful is if you put your list down and allow people to come in a specific road meeting, publicize it maybe a little better, and put it out there that you can be here and people understand you're seventh on the list and you're never going to get there. I think that's hard to hear. Even if it is what happens,
yeah.
I just think it's hard for someone.
Maybe never is not the word, but like, you know, you might not move up if other ones, you know.
Right, and I hope people just need to understand that and be heard and have a voice. So
yeah.
That would be my recommendation. I live right off the Silver Creek Road, so I'm good.
And Dave Christensen came to the day. He goes north, right? He goes south of north.
Yeah.
You already know about that.
Yeah, we have some improvements for Crescent North, Crescent South, because of the drainage and state there's all of those have some drainage issues, the steepness of the road. The hard part is it's not a hard surface, but every time there's a heavy storm, snow melt, it pours and runs into fissures, and those fissures, that's where the water runs away, the water pond, and then it falls
over again.
Challenges are, those are not the county standard.
Getting those roads paved, which would be ideal to make them a hard surface so they don't keep losing all that material down. We have to have a pretty good contractor. So that's where you're talking north of $500,000 to get a contractor engineer that would come in and pave those roads because they're pretty steep. And they're a good product.
How many, and again, I know the axiom that for every person you want to pave, someone else doesn't.
Yeah.
To pave the roads that are in the absolute worst shape, what does it cost roughly per mile to do it?
Probably, well, it's not just paving. So I understand we're building the subsurface and then working up to over the pavement, just a band-aid on the broken arm. Per mile, you're probably now, I haven't costed out in a while. It used to be $1 million a mile that was an easy number, but I was like, that was 10 or 15 years ago. You're probably $4 million a mile.
Probably.
But in this, I understand, I got to remove some of the crap material that's there to kind of do a build on. I got to go down, build it up. That's if you want a true twin light, which what the Summit County did, that Silver Creek to Bittner, I think our project ended up being, because we designed that, I think it was 11 to 12 months.
Wow.
It is an undergrowth, yeah. Right? With a trail, it has a lot of amenities. It's got retaining walls. It's got other expensive features.
And how long is it?
How long is it? 1.8 miles, I think. So, but retaining walls, roundabout.
Where is it? What's that?
Dirt roads are always more expensive to maintain.
Okay. But you got to find the balance between maintaining a little bit every year versus $4 million a month.
Our budget, but that's what I say. When you say a budget is $150K is your maintenance, $120K is your capital improvement project.
It's a long time before you get $4 million a month.
And keep in mind for the board members, especially the new ones, Silver Creek has over 26 miles of roads that were possible.
So it almost sounds like part of the answer to all these people with their complaints about the roads is like we can't, you know, right, especially the ones who want to pave, right? It's just like, we're not even close, we're not even in the ballpark of having the budget to pave these roads. So you need to stop thinking about that. Like, that's never going to happen.
So it's I would say there's a fine balance. One, some people have moved to those places to get remote and rural, but now you're asking somebody to pave. Yeah. To your remote and rural location.
Yeah.
Right.
If you wanted a nice, I don't think the road was any different when you bought your home or whatever it is. They've never been ideal. When I moved here, they were all dirt roads from past belts.
Right.
So what I drive on today is a whole lot better than it used to be. I'd also say we are the only location in the county. We're not. We should be thankful for what the county does for us. We're the only service area that gets money from the funds the county gets every year. Everybody else is on their own to maintain their roads.
Why is that?
We struck a deal a long time ago that we don't want to turn our back on. So we get a portion of what's called the BNC funds.
Okay.
It comes into the county, and no one else gets it. So I was there the last 20 years. That's how we've been able to inch our way towards better roads. But, it'll not...
It'll
never be ideal.
We love
our
dirt roads.
Yeah. Some people love it, right? And that's the...
Well, I've heard stories of it. Like, realtors have sold houses to people. Oh, they're going to pave that or something.
Don't make the road better. Then people go faster.
The other caveat. Then we make it too nice and we'll have them slow. We'll put the potholes back in. And everyone will fly out. I'll go over it. 35 miles per hour.
Is the biggest complaint potholes from people that want their road done? Or
I think from a staff perspective, it's potholes and pave my dirt road that I just bought.
Those are the
two largest, and every time we have a road discussion, half half for people and please pay and the other half for please don't pay. You know, because I bought it on a dirt road. Mm-hmm.
But it's a moot point because taking in $4 million a mile.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's the only number we need to tell them at this point. It's like, it's $4 million a mile. Our budget is $120,000.
Yeah.
Like, so 40 years from now, if we don't spend any of that, we'll do it.
We did in last year's proposal, we did say if a group of citizens came forward and said we would like to help fund a project. And once again, when I tell you $4 million, that's building the road the way it should be done. We haven't built the road at Silver Creek the way it should be done. We've never done the way it should be done. Even what we did last year was the best we could. That what we put down was 3 inches of asphalt on 6 inches of untreated base course. The project next to us had 12 inches of granular borrow on 8 inches of untreated base course on 4 inches of asphalt. So they were twice the depth of the ground.
Where was that?
From Edge of Ours, from the Bittner, from the roundabout, Mammoth Drive.
Yeah.
Oh, all that, that's what all that was built, like this. Ours was built there.
Which is ours? You're talking Silver Creek here?
Yeah, Silver Creek.
So they're going to be redoing that again?
No.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha. How much is that in tax?
Significant. Yeah, there's actually in every contract, there is a oil barrel price, so it really changes dramatically as contractors have an ability to renegotiate the price of the asphalt.
But my understanding is when you look at a bid, the cost of asphalt is actually really low compared to the cost of prep work, correct?
It's hard because when we say asphalt, it's the placement and the work associated. There's also other unit prices, like on the road we did Silver Creek last year, asphalt was probably $160 a ton. Untreated base course was like $70 a ton, so that portion below it. Asphalt's typically one of the more expensive things for this area.
But as far as the labor and everything going into the prep work.
Yeah.
Actual price for the asphalt. If you get the prep work perfect, it's super cheap to put asphalt on it, right?
It's a lot of the work. Yeah. The prep work, making sure. Because if you don't have the prep work, the asphalt won't last.
Yeah.
So, without it, it's...
But you see how fast it goes down, too, right? Like, they take forever prepping it, and then one day they come in, and it's like...
And it's like, oh, that happened to Crescent North, because they got, like, less than 2 years, it just got destroyed, and they had to take it all out.
We never paid Crescent
North. Well, whatever it was, you had some black thing going on that road, but it's integrated over.
There was a little rotomail put on the front end, on the flat, from Silver Creek in for about 1,500 feet, and we actually pulverized it for design on that.
Okay.
So it's, like, rock hard, but there's issues.
Is that the gel?
No.
What is the gel that you guys put on?
So the Permazine, it's not a gel, it's an enzyme that it's water-based enzyme.
Oh.
And what that does is it bonds linate soils with aggregates that create that hard surface. And it actually supposedly increases hardness over time. But we did identify some of the original projects that were done. The contractor was very new to that project or using that material. And the manufacturer actually sent their representatives, engineers out to help us evaluate the roads to see what happened. And it was just application wasn't done correctly.
Are you referring to the slurry when you say gel on the road?
You're talking about mad chloride.
Mad chloride.
Road.
That's on the dirt roads.
I got lower red in quarter.
Before we put the rotomail down. Sorry.
Yeah.
What is that stuff?
Mad chloride.
Mad chloride.
What they're on dirt roads. I don't do that every year. It's a dust down.
I have a quick question about the sidewalk, just in particular.
Sure.
They had supposed to be like, I know the one by right coming up Silver Creek Road in front of the Lichten House there. I know that one is like a sheet of ice. And is there any recommendations that you could make to the service area? Because I know my son personally was in an accident in that area
there's been other people who I've seen slipping on that. I don't know if you've witnessed that. Yeah, the crosswalk.
I would have to refuse myself because I hate the crosswalk.
Well, it's not a matter of hate. They're there.
They're crossing across the street.
Correct.
Okay.
Is there a way during the snow season, during the early ice, or now, whatever, that you can help us research safety procedures on those crosswalks because they are extremely slick and creating ice patches?
But the water's going to get hot in that
Yeah.
You guys take courses on that?
No, I don't even try. No.
I'd
rather go over a
My highest recommendation, like, we don't do this on our own. You don't salt on their roads, right?
You don't salt on roads, but could you salt those sidewalks?
Salt, or you could put sand. Like, some sort of, if you wanted to, UDOT also uses the red sand at times, depending on where you're at with UDOT, they put a red sand. So
we can put
something like that down that would help it melt and create some traction. That's probably the easiest way.
And how many of those crosswalks do we have in Plymouth Green?
Seven.
So is that something that we need to vote on, or how does best practice go to make sure that we can do that for the safety of the community, the safety of everyone?
The board's directive to staff to, I don't maintain, make recommendations. My recommendation would be that I would suggest to the trustees that you have the staff sand those.
Can we add that, Chris, to add sidewalks?
Well, if they sand, I can probably ask them to sand a higher amount.
Or is it a different type of sand? You're recommending a red sand?
If there's a red sand, I would say you have the county. If they use any sand, that would be good.
So we're bringing that from North Slope where the county did it. So there's some other options. We can probably ask for squeegee or something before we go to the salt portion.
What's greasy, Chris?
It's a black crushed lava rock.
Something that rock needs material.
But the blackness
melts.
It's what they sprinkle from the helicopter to get nearly.
I mean, I've seen three accidents in that. I only go that path, so I can't say what I've seen for the other ones. But I've seen three cars off the road after or before.
So I can give them some directions to sand it at a higher amount there, and we can see, and if it doesn't improve, then we can recircle it.
But if it doesn't improve, that we have to have another accident to see that it didn't improve, or to be...
Well, I don't know how to evaluate it other than putting down a heavier amount of
sand. I mean, I'd also say accidents, there's a lot of caveats to how accidents...
Yeah, of course. I mean,
that it's all just because the crosswalk,
it seems to advantage that there's so many in that spot. You're running off an IC road.
To give a little caveat to that, you're saying that they go down the hill?
Up or down.
Okay. So,
it's
on the speed flashing sign going up Silver Creek, past
Scott's house. No.
Past Scott's house, everyone knows that. And then one cross. Someone actually hit on the opposite side of the road going up
there. They hit my tree going up.
So, I mean, part of it is user, driver error, but also we can evaluate and get that sand down and then we can see. I mean, I'm not hearing about a lot of accidents unless people involved in those are letting me know so that we can address it. It's like what I spoke of earlier with the garbage truck. The garbage truck is not servicing if you can't get up and down the road. So we increase the sanding on those roads on garbage days. I can give Wolf a little direction and then if you guys can give more information to us, I won't know. Cause
I mean, I think I drive it probably 15 times a day, so if I see other cars, I can tell you.
Just a little more input. I'm not driving 26 miles of the road every day either. So,
and just an FYI for the perspective of your board members, one of the reasons why we try to avoid salt's kind of our last recourse on those really problem areas that happen a few times a year. Area-wide, Chris and I attend a water meeting with all the water districts in comparing water quality, et cetera. The entire state is starting to, or at least northern Utah, is starting to see exponential increase in TDS, total dissolved solids, in everyone's wells because of the salt being used on the roadways. Because our area is predominantly wells. We're trying to protect our aquifer. So sand becomes a first choice. And then salt in those calm areas when we do have the negative 20 days, that just turns everything to ice. We will salt and sand those intersections for safety or those areas.
So the days that actually those roads were the slickest were not the coldest days. They were early season before we had snow and there was condensation, and that's where there was the most problem. So I think, unfortunately, I think the thought is if salt is bad for the roads and for the environment and for the animals and for our water, that's valid. But if taking those 7 sidewalks and making them safer for the community, you have to look at the cost-benefit analysis because they're small little areas, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't in the extreme cold temperatures that those incidents happened. It was like the weird weather patterns. Like, I know my property was much icier early this year because we just didn't have a snow base. So I can speak only for my own home, but I think it's just something that we should look to see if we could mitigate and make it safer because the sidewalks are, like Scott said, absorbing water and really slick.
And we're spraying Roundup.
Yeah.
So we're worried about salt and animals, but we're spraying one of the most toxic substances we can, the Trudeau-Johnson.
So is there any other road updates? Anything?
No. Sorry, there was one other on the capital project, or I think it was the capital maintenance, to put some road mill tailings on Greenville.
There's an undeveloped section of green field that connects from Valley Drive to Mammoth Drive. We're seeing quite a bit pick up now of traffic on it where we didn't have it before because of Mammoth Drive. So,
do you ever see federal money that's available to us that we would not necessarily see on our radar? We do a lot of federal projects. Federal dollars are expensive dollars. I would say you don't want to touch federal dollars unless you're north of $1 million. Even then, I would question.
No grants or anything like that for rural residential ag community.
I've looked in.
Yeah, we don't want to be credit.
I look at that every year. Nothing great. Our zip code and our average household income puts us out of that. And then if we were, it's very expensive.
Okay.
Great engineering, just to
So thank you so much, Gary. I guess the question is, how do we make you available, like some of the constituents were asking, like if there's additional questions from the community, or like how does that work? Like what's best practice?
We can do it at work. I live here. Just let me know if you want to do one of these things. I can make myself
available. Or we can just ask you to attend.
Save you money. If I don't have anything to add, I try not to show up. You can sit here and watch me work on something else and pay me for 2 hours, so I'll go home and do my own thing.
I agree.
So,
thank you so much.
Hey,
Gary, unrelated question, but they're going to repave I-80, that section, right?
Yes, they are.
Are they going to, by any chance, use that new high-density asphalt that they use at the bottom?
They're laying that down in a lot of places now. They're having a lot of good performance.
Yeah, I've heard good things about it.
It's done well.
Yeah.
So that's the intention for this year. There's not 100% proof on why it didn't perform.
On the one that's there now.
The one that's there now.
Was it like within 6 months? I mean, they taped it in summer. It was like that winter now.
There's no proof, so it's not like they can't go back up the contractor and everything like that.
So we're going to get all that traffic again? We're going to get the same traffic we got last year?
Yeah, but we can sneak through. You can go on the front of court all the way to Jim Green's front of court.
Thank you, Gary.
Thanks, Gary.
So before we move close session, I had a question for Nathan while we were still on the record, back into kind of like the election of the board officers and like responsibilities of the board. And to Nathan, this is a question I have personally. Noting like Article 5 and 4 and 5 of like the bylaws and resolutions
in the different policies that we have, like the personnel policy and some of that. There are, like, since there are several board members and we have a full board now, there are things that we talked about kind of loosely, like finalizing job descriptions, finalizing performance reviews. In there, there's goals and job coaching, and then an annual review of the personnel policy. How do you recommend we tackle that? Like, do you recommend we establish committees leveraging the people that aren't in elected positions? Do you recommend, because those things are supposed to be done annually and that's in our doctrine, that we look at those to add those to the next board meeting to discuss them and a timeline for them? You know, we had talked about last year, we had talked to John about making sure that the performance reviews were done before March. But I would just love to better understand, like, your recommendations, how we can solidify that while we have a board and a forum here today.
Yeah, so we can't vote on it. It's not something that's noticed up for action on the agenda. But I think that the board typically has looked at its personnel policy each year. And as I've mentioned to some of you individually and collectively, one of my recommendations, long-standing recommendations, we take all these disparate policies and regulations and we put it into a uniform code, just like you would have with a city code. I think that would help, you know, make all this a lot cleaner. But to your more specific question, it's really up to the board, and there's no right or wrong answer. You know, and I've seen the board, this board and other boards I represent, do it differently. It just depends on the skill set of the board members you have and their interest and availability. Sometimes people are like, hey, let's have the chair do it, but other times people are like, hey, we've got these other board members that have a skill set that lends itself to this particular assignment. So it's really up to the board and how you want to go about doing the employee evaluations. John, I think in the past these were typically done, at least the last couple of, I know.
No, they were never done, Nathan.
I know that they were done maybe before John's time when Marla was there. Vince, I seem to recall that there was when we had fewer staff, but it's really up to you. If you want to assign a specific board member to do it, you can do that. If you want to have a committee, you can do that too. The only thing with the committee is you just need to make sure it's of a certain size that it doesn't trigger quorum requirements. There's no right or wrong. It just depends on who wants to do it and who's best suited to do it.
And so if we've already kind of started on some of those practices where we had kind of designated individuals to work on that, we could just keep running with that in terms of it doesn't have to be formalized like an election.
Yeah, absolutely. And that could just be up to what the board wants to do. It's the board's call.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think the personnel policy that we have reviewed every year, and I do think we need to review it. I don't think there's a timeline in there. It just needs to be reviewed during the calendar year at some point.
Great. That's helpful, and I think that just gives us the guidance that what we had kind of set with John as the schedule in terms of completing those performance reviews by the end, you know, the beginning of March, getting those job descriptions. I think we were going to have them by the end of the year. Okay, so don't think we've seen those. So just to kind of like follow back up with the staff to make sure that we followed what we had kind of all discussed.
Okay. Yeah, if that's what the board wants to do, the board can continue on the current track. It can always change course if it wants to do so.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
And for the board members, so we have our personnel policy, as Nathan says, we do review that every year, and typically that's done within the first quarter each year, so we'll continue with that. And Gary, I do have the job descriptions that I can get to the board.
Okay, thank you so much, John, and I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, I think we will open it back up to general public comments. Please keep your comments to 3 minutes, stating your name and address, and then after that, we will go into closed session.
Please share so 85899 view. Put into the meeting. It's disconcerting that the staff would be redacting information that goes to the board when the board is supposed to be redacting the staff. So I think as constituents that we make us feel better that you guys are seeing everything. And as far as all that personnel policy stuff, we did have some issues prior to this new board. So following up with that, I think the constituents are looking for that as well, so I hope it's not dropped.
If you could clarify your
name and address, sir. I know you already
said. Sally White, 1230 St. Joe's, RCD Hutton Harmony. I think I just heard you say that you connected with other cities to look at their water policies, or you and Chris are on some kind of service area where you talk with other water policies to make assessments. Did I get that?
No, there's something called concurrency where you report to what you.
Our concurrency is our water system is reviewed and regulated by the Summit County Health Department as well as the other water companies within Schenectady Basin. So we go over a lot of stuff as a group. We meet and go over stuff until we talk about different things. And that concurrency report is what Vince was referring to on the TDS levels. They're seeing it extremely high, like in Park City, Mountain Regional's wells, because of the road salt that's putting down, because a lot of their water system is really close to roads and so forth, where our wells are away from I-80, and we don't salt the roads. So that's what he was referring to at that point.
Okay. Because I was just saying, if you talk about other things, it would seem to be hugging the precedent to talk about different water basics of hitting those algorithms for differences. It just seems like earlier that we're doing a water study and it's completely closed study. So there's other service areas or service districts or someone who has other issues, so we can compare if our rates are consistent with those in similar areas. It just seems kind of insular, not to look external as well, to make those informed decisions. I don't know if I was very clear on the water question.
Yeah, I think what I heard when that was explained was that the study was insular because it had to be, because there's so many differences between, like, how big the district is, how many people it serves, you know, connected versus non-connected, the infrastructure and all that stuff. So I think that was part of it. I mean, I think after you do a sanity check and say, okay, the number you come up with, how does that compare to all the other ones? But
a high-level sanity check at Summit Water right across the street, they're starting monthly is $138 a month or $180.
All of that just sounded like another way to say we want to put through a rate increase and we're going to figure out a way to do it. So I appreciate that, Rick, we're teammates, but that's what that sounds like.
Well, I'm just repeating what I heard in the what the study was.
Right. I agree that you heard that.
Yeah.
It sounds like we are so unique that, you know, nobody else around us would matter.
Yeah.
So capital projects is a different thing, so I acknowledge that. Right, but you know, we're not so unique in the world.
Yeah, well, that's why I said I think there needs to be, you know, you do a, you look at the number right from that study, and then I would say, okay, sanity check: is this way higher, way lower than people around us? And if so, did we make a mistake, or you know?
I think it has to be more than a sanity check. I think it has to be based on data and facts and analysis. Right. I mean, like, when we went through this, rural water is supposed to be one data point. It's not supposed to be the end all. Rural water isn't just go on because rural water says there is other facts and analysis. If we look back at, you know, what Vince had prepared and, you know, this compares other communities. So was that all BS or are we going to still, I think that still has to come into play.
But I think we're also talking about apples and steering wheels here. The rural water study is specific to what connected users are paying. The rural water study, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is my understanding, has nothing to do with the excess usage fees that would theoretically be applied to people who hit certain tiers who are not connected. Is that
right? Basically, it's to say, are you financially sound in your water system, your expenses, your revenue, your capital, your depreciation, your age of your infrastructure, and what needs to be replaced.
The problem is there's no trust. That's the problem.
Well, it's not.
It's not okay that there's no trust, guys.
Especially when we're hearing that stuff is being kept from the board, which is supposed to represent the community. That's not okay.
So, just to address that, like, stuff was not being held from the board. Vince wrote an email to the board that Curry was asking for the race or the study results, and Vince basically said, it's not really done yet. We're having a meeting literally tomorrow morning, and, you know, let us go through this and we'll sort this out so the information is
that's not
more
the
complete.
Staff's position to hold
in
that.
And so Carrie's pushback was, I want to see it anyway. And so that was the discussion we had.
But
and
that was withholding information from the board.
He didn't say he wouldn't do it.
He did.
No, he didn't.
Yes, he did. I'll read the email. He did.
Hold on. If you're going to talk about me, you're going to discuss the record straight. The information we held was private account names, address information.
But that's not what you first
said.
His
attorney said you didn't have to do that. The board should have, right? But you decided you know I said it.
So that means Vince decided he was protecting the information.
No.
Which it doesn't mean to.
That was inaccurate. You even chimed in on the record and said, I don't feel like the board needs to see this because it could bog us down and we don't need to look at this yet. I prefer for it to wait until, you know, he gets his meeting and he has it. So that is not the truth. We were denied until I pushed back to ask to see it, regardless. I don't care if I didn't see the proprietary information. I just wanted to be a part so that when we go to the community, we can say, we've been along for the ride. We've been a part of everything. John had given the mandate to the rest of the staff that we should be included in all communications. We have not been included in one communication with Rural Water. We never saw the data sets that were provided, nothing. So that is not an accurate accounting of what happened yesterday over the last couple of days. We were denied until Nathan had to chime in and say that the board should be able to have this. If they choose to read it, great. If they don't want to read it, great. But you didn't give up. You said for him, I prefer for him not to share it.
I didn't direct him. I said my preference is not to share an imperfect spreadsheet. That would exactly result in the situation we have now.
But Let me finish.
Nathan clarified what he should do.
And then he agreed.
Yeah. He still withheld information.
But he withheld it because he was afraid that if he said he was unsure that he should see all the everyone's private information. And all this. I was in the office.
Nathan's email says.
I know his email.
That was after.
I'm telling you his initial thought. He didn't want to put the service area in jeopardy.
Let's move
the
fire
session. Sharing is right. Information.
Can we adjourn, please, and then go to fire session?
I don't think it's something we need to talk about in private session. I think it's been brought up to from the community.
He was there in a side of caution.
Okay.
And then once Nathan chimed in, then he agreed, then he was okay with it. But initially, he was being cautious, which is the prudent thing to do. He was afraid to just blast out everyone's information. He thought that was a problem.
But he could have been given it. He still withheld that even after Nathan said it, Otto. He still withheld that. So the thing is, the board works, the staff works for the board. They roll up to the board, and we support the community. We're nominated, we're elected by the for the community.
What did he withhold after Nathan chimed in?
He withheld all the additional private information.
Okay, so I motion to adjourn.
It's not a topic we can discuss and close.
Nathan's going to jump in.
So I need to go over some things and close. I need to go over some pending litigation. But I do think this discussion falls within professional character, physical and mental health, a competence of an individual, which is something that you can have a closed session to discuss.
Who's the individual?
Well, if you're talking about what Vince did, it would be Vince.
I don't think we're talking about what Vince did. I think we're saying the staff needs to make everything available that we are, it should be all available to all of us.
We are talking about what Vince did.
No, let's talk about to take Vince out of it. The staff should be including
And if the board wants to be a part of things, wants to see things, they should do that too.
So I will agree with you that I think, just talking in general, I will agree with you that I think that the board should be entitled to any of the information.
Okay. That's it. That's the end of what I'm saying.
Okay.
That's it.
However, I also feel like that I don't want to be a micromanager as a board member. We're guiding. They are paid to do a job, and they're supposed to do the job, and we should oversee to make sure that things are. So if you want to be involved in everything, personally, I don't want to spend time on something that
isn't done. It's the biggest thing over the last 12 months. So that something.
And
that,
so you wanted to see it. And so basically Nathan said, okay, yeah, you could see it. And then he sent it to you.
It actually didn't go as smoothly as
that. I know. I saw the link didn't work. Okay.
It wasn't that smooth. Yeah. But we can agree to disagree.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, they have to do their job, and I don't want to be involved in her job every day either. But something as big as the water, where we actually went to John and were like, hey, look, this is a really big deal for the community. We, the optics haven't been good. There's a lot of finger pointing about the staff and all of that and how they came up with the rates. Let's make it so that us as a board can be along with the ride. And when we do come up with the rate, we could say, you know what, constituents, we've been a part of this the entire time, and everything was done properly, and we can support and endorse the research and all of the work that the staff does. So that's all I'm saying.
Right.
Well, and Rick, let me just, again, we'll probably see each other later on.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what's really important is the path was that we took to get here, right?
Yeah.
And Sally had some nice things to say. And I think the last couple of board meetings were much better in terms of how we all should operate. But there was some real question about either motives or competence throughout 2024.
Sure.
At the last meeting that I was at the Richens building, what I heard is you guys specifically say, okay, the staff was going to speak to Rural Water, and there were some board members that wanted to participate in that so that they could have an understanding of what some of the inputs were into that model. What I heard here tonight was that there was no board members involved, and even worse, the staff member didn't want to get. Now, I've dealt with plenty of documents where you could give over the study and redact the personal information. There's no reason to hold the entire study. So, of course, that's going to make the public question, you know, what's going on.
They're not holding the study back whatsoever.
They were at first.
That's what it sounded like to me.
No, but they're not.
Okay. So the first study, I actually saw it because I was in the office, food stuff, and he showed me in a glaring, like you mentioned, that the models they use, the numbers don't even make any sense whatsoever. There's the initial one they sent out. So the meeting tomorrow, he's going to go in there, and they're going to figure it out. So even looking at it, it was virtually useless.
As a guy that does modeling in my job regularly, if I got an early view of it, and you guys can all say, yeah, that's all ridiculous, but if I got an early view of it as a board member, I would just be looking at the inputs. Yeah, the outputs might not make any sense right now.
That's what they're going to go and do.
But to me, that should be a dialogue that every one of you guys sitting around the table should want to know. I don't know why you wouldn't want to know it and why everybody wouldn't get it. Right?
And why you were able to see it, I was told no at first.
I was in here signing invoices, and he had just got it, and he was...
But then you should have said Otto was able to see it, here's it for the rest of the board.
Otto only looked at, I looked at the numbers, not the personal information. And I called her and said, $222 million for 1 month, when all the other months were $80,000. And I'm like, yeah, I don't want to be wasting any time putting too much time into this because it's obviously flawed. When it's correct and right, that's the one I want to look at, and then it's going to make sense.
So I would just rebut that again by saying the sooner somebody gets to look at it, the sooner they know the structure of the model, they know how to read it, they understand some of the inputs, they can then, when they get something back, actually waste less time on that and more time on what the actual outputs are saying, and you guys could have a normal debate. That's
to me the way a functioning organization would run and look at things. That's all. And just, again, I know nothing other than what I heard in this meeting, and it feels really dysfunctional.
Yeah.
Right? So notwithstanding all of the nice things that Sally said, all the nice things that we felt at the last couple of meetings, this feels like we're already going back to a prior functioning model that doesn't work well.
Yeah, I think I can see how you see that from the outside because of the way of the nature of the discussion. But
it was the meeting, not this discussion that happened here. It was what was said in the meeting itself that raised the red
flag.
This meeting.
Yeah, that's
right.
But not that discussion.
That just happened now. The discussion that happened during the meeting raised the red flag for us, the few of us that are here, and it will be
Which part?
Just why was this information redacted? He got
on the phone. Yeah, right. It sounds, I mean, literally, he said tomorrow morning they're meeting.
Right.
To like figure out
what the issue is. And you invite people to go to that meeting. How am I supposed to go in the meeting if I hadn't at least been able to see something? And I still don't have what John had directed the staff to provide to us that he was giving to Rural Water to be able to understand the full picture. As a board member who's going to vote on this, I want to know everything. I want to be a part of the full entire journey. And I would hope every one of us would want that.
But you guys said publicly at the last meeting at Richmond that the board was going to be involved with Rural Water and looking at what the inputs were, how that was going to work. And it doesn't sound like that happened. So, again, just sitting here as the public, that just feels crappy, right? That just feels like somebody somewhere is directing something to happen and doesn't want other people involved.
My recollection was we were going to get the study.
But it wasn't just the studies, Rick, that we were supposed to get. We were supposed to get this, all of the communication.
Right. That's what we heard from
the input.
Right.
What goes into the study. We want to be involved.
Okay, so that's, now we're getting down to micromanaging versus...
No, the water, that's not micromanaging. That's being educated. I'm going to be voting on something. That is being educated. That is not micromanaging.
We're on schedule. This is going off course. We've got to move towards the litigation issues that are now facing us.
At some point, you guys will start listening to the community, right? I know you don't care. You care.
I'm clearly sitting here. Why wouldn't I care?
Well, because I think you might have your own, Westwood stuff to worry about. But at the end of the day, there's some things that were told to the public at the last meeting, and you guys just ignored it. You just didn't do it. Now, I give everybody the benefit of the doubt here, except when we see things that are clearly just wrong. But one of the things that you guys said at the meeting, which you can go back to and listen to, but you said the board was going to be involved in speaking to Rural Water. That clearly didn't happen. And then we hear that when they just asked for the study, that wasn't even provided. So that's why you may not think it's productive. This is the only opportunity that we have to see what you guys are doing in a community that we're all involved in. So it may not be productive to you. It's the only chance we have to let you know what we think.
Anyway,
I just want to follow up one quick second. I just want to say I do back Terry and what she has said because you guys are supposed to be doing this on our behalf. I truly don't know anything about it. So it's very helpful when the board gets involved and can educate me as well. So I just want to thank everyone for all your time.
Thank you, Ben.
Motion to adjourn the meeting. So can you just make a motion to go into closed session and then you can do this? Okay. What's that? Motion to go into closed session to discuss the character, professional confidence, or physical or mental health of an individual pending report imminent militarization and or the sale or purchase of real property for Tennessee House Code 52-4-204-3205.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Sure, motion. Second.
And recording.
All right.
7:45 p.m. Nathan, we'll turn it over to you.